This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Ken Krimstein about his amazing book, The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt. The subtitle is A Tyranny of Truth, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but thanks, Ken, for doing this.
Well, this is great fun. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
This is, well, it's an amazing book. It is a, you know, it's hard, I wouldn't, you know, you might call it a graphic novel, but really, to me, it's an illustrated biography.
Yeah.
In cartoonish, cartoon-like form, because you are a cartoonist.
Yes.
And I have to ask, you know, I know you do cartoons for The New Yorker and a bunch of other magazines. That's been your primary work, right?
Yes, yeah. Typically what we call gag cartooning or single panel, you know,
right,
where there's like a picture and a caption,
right,
or the picture is a joke in itself.
Right.
You know,
and so, and your comedic talent is in finding that moment in time which tells a story.
Yeah.
A scene that tells an entire story.
Right. It's like the visual and the caption have to the viewer completes the equation,
right,
sort of.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and of course, the natural question is, how the hell did you become that?
A gag cartoonist?
Yeah.
Let's see. My dad was an artist too, so there was always paper and pencils around the house.
He worked in advertising.
He was in advertising, but he went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and he was, mm-hmm, a fine painter, and he always had stuff around the house. And I was always the kid that could draw. And when, you know, Mad Magazine was my life, and then when I went to Boy Scouts, I didn't learn how to tie any knots or anything, but a kid smuggled a couple of R. Crumb comics.
That's pretty subversive.
It was very subversive. And I thought to myself, wow, I love this. And then...
So did you get off on Crumb?
I thought his drawing was, and his storytelling
unbelievable,
was... to a kid, you know, who was at that time living in the suburbs of Chicago, it was a portal to an alternative reality.
So did you read things like Zippy the Pinhead?
I read everything that I could. But at the same time, a friend of mine's father, who went to an Ivy League school, had a very classy guy, had a couple of Charles Adams anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked at those and I saw the nature of that type of work, again, it just delighted me so much that I tried to, you know, I drew comic characters, but then I tried to figure out why did I love those things more? And it's because they had an idea and they made me feel a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was pursuing that, you know, every school newspaper, everything. And then from time to time, cartoonists would come into my purview, whether it be in the long form comic book or it be in, you know, if I saw B. Kleban, I mean, I was a devoted reader of National Lampoon,
mm-hmm,
and I just couldn't get enough. Dan Wilson in the long form and the short form. I just kept working it and kept working it. And I realized, it's funny, I moved to New York. And I was working in an ad agency, too, and I was drawing constantly. And Sam Gross once said to me, he said, you know, why'd you move to New York? And I said, well, you know, I think my office, because the office was around the corner from The New Yorker. And I just submitted every week. And he said, not a lot of gag cartoonists in Chicago, not a lot of, and it's true. So this is where the Mecca was, and it's what I wanted to do.
So how long did it, how long did it take? I mean, this is like...
Oh,
before you got your first piece published.
I'm going to say 8-9 years, 8 years, of constant rejection and submission.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder than, it was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be.
Have you ever, like, talked to a bunch of kids in art schools and kind of told them that, how hard it is?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. And, you know, some get it and some don't, but, you know... you know, there's a craft to it, and you learn over time. And when I first started doing this, I thought, you know, I just want my style. You know, no, you can't just like force it. It just takes time. You have to figure out how to do it.
So, but you develop a style. Do you feel like your style does it grow and change as you change as a person?
I suppose so. It depends how much leeway you allow yourself to play while you're doing it. and if you're repeating yourself. So, for instance, as I moved into the longer form with this, I really had to go to my whole toolkit. And I actually, one of the things that really helped me here was I went deep and I got the old rapidograph pen out. Of course, that didn't work, so I threw it away. For those of you who don't know, that's an ancient German writing instrument, which clogs up after one use. But I went and bought a new one, and that didn't work. But then I got another one. It worked. And I was like, that took me right back to high school when I first really started doing, like I would call pen and ink.
Yeah.
And that transported me. And then that allowed me to get into this new space, because I typically don't draw with that type of pen. And then I started using pencil, and I was allowing myself. But I had done – the other thing is, I must add, I have to tell you, I worked on the writing for this. So this is one thing I learned from The New Yorker, too, and I can't believe it translated into this longer form. But you got to write it first. You got to have the idea first.
Oh, that's it. You know? Makes sense.
You know, as somebody said, as I think it was Bob Mankoff or somebody said, it's not the ink, it's the think. And all I wanted to do was draw, but I wouldn't let myself. I had to crack the code, so to say.
So that kind of gets me to the question about the book.
Yeah.
I mean, since you've been a cartoonist, as you call it, a gag cartoonist, where you're doing essentially an entire story in a panel,
right?
Single panel. What prompted you? What inspired you to shift from that to telling a longer story, much longer story? This is a biography of Hannah Arendt, who is a very important person, and there's a lot of story to be told. Now, one advantage you have, I think, is that her story is incredibly action-packed.
Yes.
You know, I think people who don't know her life, and I would say, as I'm sort of embarrassed to say, until I read this,
I think a lot of people don't know her life. I mean, that was one of the things when I opened the biography, because I was always sort of interested in her, and I have to add that I always, while I was working on the gag cartooning, I was also working on medium form pieces. I've written a lot of 1,200,000 word humor pieces for things like McSweeney's and stuff like that, or little gag. So I was always working on writing at the same time. I wrote a couple of horrendous novels.
They go in the drawer?
They were in the drawer. They went into the drawer. But I think I probably learned, you know. So I was always trying to figure out how to do the longer form. I was always studying that. So I believed that I could tell a story of a certain length that had a hook to it. So when I embarked on this, well, when I looked at it, and like you say, there were so many episodes. And as I dipped into her biography, these episodes just jumped out at me, and they were rich and strange.
Yeah.
Rich and strange. Like, why did she go to a graphology, a handwriting analysis, almost seance, late in her life? I couldn't answer it.
How does that fit into
her thinking?
Thinking, yeah.
Right. What effect did the fact that her father died of syphilis when she was 7 or 8
right.
years
well, there's
old.
There's a whole lot of story there untold.
Yeah. And why did she work to save as a Zionist in the 30s in Germany at great risk, trying to help Jewish children escape from Europe and Paris in the 40s?
Before she left. I think was – she left in 1932, 33?
She left Germany in 33.
Yeah.
After – a while after Hitler took power. So just questions and incidents and things. And I thought, wow, if I can, you know, drive to those in stories. And you have to also understand that, like, I read comic books like crazy when I was a kid, and The Crumb and that sort of stuff. So I love pictorial storytelling, but I had to find a through line and an arc. And hard with her, mm-hmm. and to keep the consistency, and you know, and also finding a way to draw her so that you could tell it was her from childhood to young adolescence to, you know, older adolescence. I mean, almost every phase of her life.
So when to do that, did you – now I know, having worked with artists, some artists feel like they have to go back to the original photograph.
Yeah.
and whether they're doing an exact representation or an inspired by, they need the original.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, well, I'm assuming you don't have photographs of her at every stage of her life.
No. But there's a fair amount. But, you know, what happened was I would say there are about 20 or 30 photographs of her. I knew them all intimately, but I couldn't crack the code. I tried. And then something emerged that hadn't been seen before, and it was kind of one of those kismet-type things when you're working. And, you know, the Facebook, you know, popped it up, and the French Bibliothèque Nationale found her library card from 1939. And this, she was like 33 years old, and it was a totally different look at her that had never been seen before. It's like a three-quarter look. And then I felt like, that's a fresh take on her. And I ran with it. It pulled all those loose strands together for me. But then I had to own her. You know, I had to make her, I hate to say this, but, you know, it's not her. She had to become like the Charlie Brown version of her, you know, or something.
Because it's not literalism.
Right.
It's she's impressionism.
A character. Yeah. She's a character. I guess sort of like what actresses do or, you know, or actors do when they're in movies.
Well, and you did. I thought this having her essentially talk to herself was the conceit that made that yours as well. And I don't mean conceit in the.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. The trick or the.
Yeah. It's a way of getting us closer to her, I think.
Yeah.
That you're trying to, you know, you're not, this is not just a dry biography recounting facts or even trying to explore her character as a kind of philosophical figure. You're telling her story, but you're inhabiting her life in a kind of, in helping to exhume some mystery as well.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of mysteries in her, I think.
Still are. I mean,
really complicated things.
Yeah.
I was really, one thing that just completely flabbergasted me was the number of amazingly important and famous people that were part of her early, particularly her early life. Now, you know, you can understand when she's one of the leading public intellectuals of the mid-20th century, everyone knows her.
Right.
Got that.
Right.
But she grows up in this incredible milieu in Germany where one name after another, and you're bringing, like,
these
no idea that she was connected to Walter Benjamin. I had
no idea. Oh, yes. Well,
wow.
Neither did I. And I'm just going to guess from looking at you and out there on Radio Land, he looks great, that we're roughly the same age. And you probably remember that there was a moment back in the day when everybody was kind of reading Walter Benjamin.
Yes.
We were obsessed because it was like, you know, you'd go to the East Village and you'd go to like the St. Mark's bookstore and you'd
pick
so
posters on the wall.
So we were all, and he was cool. I mean, he was, he did the Arcade Project and all. And then I found out not only did she know him, but they were very, very close.
Right.
Very, very close and studied together. And actually, he was the cousin of her first husband and was hung out in Berlin with her second husband. But they studied at the same study, Carol, at the Bibliothèque Nationale. And then he gives her his renowned, you know, thanks to the internet, has taken on this whole mystique of the Theses on the Philosophy of History, which sounds really, really hard and boring, but it's really quite short. It's aphorisms. And in it, he's just, it's hard to decipher. And he gives that to her. And then he goes off on his tragic. So I didn't know. And I actually do think, you know, and I'm, you know, as a storyteller and a chronicler, as he would say, a chronicler, that the nature of their relationship is so core to her thinking.
Yeah.
And I had to keep looking and keep rereading that piece like she did. You know, I found out in the biography, her and her husband, when they finally busted out of Europe and got one of the last boats out of Lisbon, they had in their satchel this Theses on the Philosophy of History, and they read it and reread it and reread it to each other. And if you read it, even if you don't understand anything, it's just off the charts writing. It's just like, who writes like this?
Yeah.
So anyways, I'm sorry to get so enthusiastic about it, but it was just...
The whole point is that there are, you come across, well, first of all, your enthusiasm comes across and the footnoting idea
brilliant. The footnoting thing was a candy for me. I mean, that was just
great.
Fun.
It was great.
Because, again, I didn't know, I knew that Weimar Germany was an interesting place. But again, as I opened the biography, like, I love Fritz Lang, you know, and I love Billy Wilder, mm-hmm. and I love Bertolt Brecht, kind of, and I love... You know, Kurt Weill and all that stuff. They all hung out.
Yeah,
they all hung out. Everybody was hanging out.
Right. It was this incredibly small world. That's the thing that you really understand from this book. That was you kind of know it, but you don't really understand how close they all were. And of course, not even to mention. And I don't know how to pronounce the names either, but Jaspers.
Carl Jaspers.
And then, you know, and he is a direct descendant of Husserl.
Yep.
And, of course, her famous relationship is with Heidegger,
right.
which is fraught
yes.
and really complicated.
Absolutely.
And sort of awful in a lot of ways, tragic.
Yep. I would agree, all of the
but
above.
But the number of people, and then, you know, and of course, in a way, she was also rescued from Europe by the famous Varian Fry.
Yes.
And Hiram Bingham.
Yep, that's right. So, Varian Fry, that's right. And then I got into, you know, again, in the current moment when refugees and all these things are becoming so much in our thought, and we have all these stateless people, and as you're reading the literature, she writes something, and I mean, she comes to New York. This is another thing that really fascinated me. She wasn't Hannah Arendt that we know when she came to New York. She was an out-of-work, freelance intellectual who couldn't really speak English. And when I heard that she took a job as an au pair in Massachusetts, I'm glad I wasn't those kids that she was au pairing.
Well, maybe you,
English.
You should be that.
She did that to learn English.
Right. Well, but so you realize that it's very similar now when you'll meet a refugee or an immigrant who turns out to have been a doctor and they might be driving a cab or they're, you know, cleaning a house or something.
Yeah. And she writes this piece in 41 or 42 called We Refugees. And, again, with her typical what I call virulent truth telling, that she says, I think she starts the essay, and boy, could she start pieces. She said, first of all, we don't like to be called refugees. But it's like, whoa, okay, sit up and pay attention.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know whether you mentioned it or someone else did, but, you know, that her work is probably better known unread. In other words, people know who she is. We all, you know, a lot of people know who, you know, is famous. And there are aphorisms and
the banality of evil and this and that.
But probably, and it's fair to say, she's, you know, it's hard to read some of her work. It's really dense.
It can be a little dense.
And she's like many brilliant people in a very different place than you are sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to get to where she is.
Yeah.
Have you read a lot of?
I did. I did. And first of all, I have to say, I don't know if this is the right word, polymath. I mean, she just knew a lot about everything. She read a lot about everything. She wasn't a traditional intellectual, and she caught a lot of flack. She pissed a lot of people off. But I read a lot of her stuff. I said to someone just after I finished working on the book, and again, you may remember the old New York Roach Motel ads. You know, the roaches check in, but they never check out.
Right.
It was also done in Spanish. Right. Once you check into Hannah Arendt's mind, you can't check out. I mean, and her writing, even in English, it just sparks. So her ideas about storytelling are just incredible to me. She had a quote that helped guide me as I was working on it. And it's, storytelling reveals meaning without committing the error of defining it.
Yes.
And it's like anybody who's ever liked a story or told a story. But I was just recently looking at another work of hers called Men in Dark Times, which is a collection of essays. And actually, two of the men are women. So she has takes some liberties with the language. But boy, when you read the stuff, sometimes you have to pay attention But she writes with a fury that I really, really liked. And
maybe that passion and fury comes from having been through so much danger and knowing the loss that you feel this sort of absolute need to tell your stories because you realize how at risk you were, how little, you know, how fragile the opportunity is. I really think that that power comes across.
Yeah, I think she was, I do think she was courageous. I don't think she was perfect. I don't think, I think, and even in her writing, she says, I'm far from perfect. One of the things that really I thought was quite interesting was she doesn't say, this is the truth, this is how it should be. She says, this is how I think it is. And, you know, tell me it's not like this. And some of those thoughts are really, really helpful and really powerful. So, but I do think, and that's what helped me too. Like, I was very curious. I read a lot of biographies. I think I've read every Beatles biography that there is because I'm amazed by the talent of the Beatles. Trying to figure out, you know, what made them tick? Why did they do that? But I have to tell you, until I actually went to Liverpool, I was lucky enough. I ditched my family. I took the one-day Beatle tour, and it was great. But till I walked those streets and saw the light, and then I started to understand. So in a graphic novel or in a comic biography or whatever you want to call this, you get to show place. And that helped me to understand what she went through. Because all of a sudden, instead of hearing that she was in a Gestapo prison for 7 days, I can put her in that prison.
You can show us.
Instead of hearing she was in the Gurs detention camp in southern France, I looked at pictures of it. And, you know, I don't know if we can say this on the podcast, but
you anything you want.
I think I called it the asshole of France or something. Yeah. I mean, it was you cannot imagine a more desolate place than Gurs. It's like if France has a who knew France had a desert?
Yeah.
You know, so these were all revelations to me.
Well, I think in terms of story, you know, kind of visual storytelling, that was really powerful for me.
Thank you.
You know, I actually enjoyed this more than it, you know, if it hadn't, if I was just reading a non-illustrated biography, I thought it was just kind of revelatory to me. So I.
And there were other parts about it that I just dug. So even, so she didn't become an instant celeb. She worked her way up the food chain. She started writing for German language little papers, and then she wrote for, and then she was hanging out with the famous, you know, New York intellectuals, the Partisan Review crowd, and Mary McCarthy became one of her buddies. But all of those people, so, you know, this was a little bit before my time, way before my time, but the reflections of that, the Partisan Review, the Cedar Bar, and I just tried to do the connection to the ongoing thing. So it's kind of interesting. 50 years, 45 years or so after she passed in 1975, her ideas continue to challenge people.
Well, and actually today, because of the time that we're in, it's kind of like another opportunity for people to think about these things in a more, you know, meaningful way. Because the ideas have been there all along, but it's sometimes it's circumstances that force you to grapple with ideas that are otherwise, you know, not available, let's say.
Yeah, and that's what she would say. She would say, you have to think. That was her big thing. You know, you have to think. You have to stare reality in the face, and you have to think. That's all we've got is our brain, you know.
But she was also a lot smarter, I think, than the average person, you know, that, yeah, you can, like, everybody can think, but she was a real...
Well, no, she was. She was extraordinary. I mean, I have to say, when I, now, you know, when I dipped into her, I thought, this is a big, you know, this is a big person, you know. I it's kind of weird. I mean, when I got started on wanting to do this, and I had encouragement and this and that, I went back to the source, and I picked up Aristotle's Poetics. Oh, heavy. Mm. But hadn't read it in a million years, and I started looking at it. And one of the things that Aristotle says is you have to pick, you know, the stories of gods and goddesses.
Yeah,
and I thought, I have to look at her. Even though she's flawed, she has to have that kind of magnitude, and you either bring them low or whatever. And she kept repaying that attention, you know. So I feel like she's somebody that I really would have loved to know. I'd give anything to be able to ask her a couple of questions. I'm lucky enough to know a couple of people who studied with her.
That's what I was
her.
Just going to ask you, if you had, you know, had the opportunity to talk to people who actually knew her.
I did. And they, you know, and I was curious, did she go to the movies? What did she eat? Yeah. You know, did she watch TV? You know, and stuff like that. And she obviously was a very captivating person, and she loved life, and she, I think she was a snob. I think she knew it. I think, but I think she loved, she wanted to prevent, like you alluded to before, the terrible things that she saw happen to a place that she really loved and a people that she really did identify with, and she didn't know how to do it. She was a woman. She wasn't a soldier. She was a thinker, a person, and nobody gave her squat. And this was what really got me. She lived on a, when she came to New York as a stateless refugee, her second husband and her mother, and her, by the way, it's well known, and I heard this from people who knew her, Martha did not like Heinrich. They didn't get along,
right.
And they all lived
like
together.
Husband, right.
And all of a sudden, I'm like, I get that. And they lived on like a fourth floor, a fifth floor
walk-up on
the west side.
West side, yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, I get this person. And but what's the fire? What's the fire in her belly that made her keep punching?
Yeah.
And so I didn't have the answer to that, and I still don't. But and I don't know if you can. I don't know if there is an answer to a person.
Well, it might be the burning fervor of intelligence. To me, there's something about that this, the power of intellect to not ever give up the curiosity, the intellectual engagement with the world, which she believed in,
yes,
I think.
She did. She believed in the world. In fact, one of the things, I mean, she believed in I kind of got it from Latin as amor mundi, love of the world. She loved the world.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, then I have to turn it into a story. So in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you know, she gave up the love of a man for the love of the world. She never had children. The world. She loved the world. And I think another thing that she says, you know, and as difficult political times and stuff happen, it's nice to dip into somebody that has this kind of depth and life. It makes you feel good. And I'm thinking about her and I lost my train of thought. But about loving the world and that was you have to think it through. Her last, and then there were these little moments, and I couldn't believe it. So, and you know, I've spoken to some other biographers, and I think this kind of happens. But for me, it was so. I'm dipping into it, and you know, what a life. So she's born in East Prussia, Königsberg, a city which has basically been leveled, and sounds like it was a new Amsterdam.
Right.
When the first horseless carriages are trundling along Cobblestone Street, she dies on the Upper West Side of Manhattan after the Ramones have started gigging, and Nixon is long resigned. Now
that's a pretty good,
that's an arc.
Yes,
That's an arc. The day she dies, kind of in a. You would say maybe in a not a bad way. She's at her friends, their great friends and patrons for dinner, and between coffee and dessert, she just sits in the chair and.
Psh, I know, and you—that's you. Have
it's
that.
In there,
yeah, it's in
but
there.
The next day they go to her apartment, and she had renounced philosophy for many reasons, which I go into in the book. Mostly, I think, because she was all about action, not thinking. But they go and they see the first sentence of her return to philosophy in her typewriter,
right.
And it's not been written. It was called On Judgment, and everybody's trying to cobble it together from notes. Like, what did, you know, everyone's hungry. What did she say?
Right.
I mean, that to me was like, you couldn't have written that, you know?
Well, and she died fairly, relatively young.
She did.
You know,
well, I think
years old?
The fact that she seemed to never be without a cigarette from age 9.
Right, and you definitely show that.
But they all did in those days,
right.
You know.
But she it may be the smoking, who knows?
Who knows?
But it was, I thought the book was really
evocative.
Thank
you so much.
And I really enjoyed it.
Well,
so,
thanks.
So what do you, are you going to do this again? Will you do another illustrated biography?
Is that— I am actually working on another project. I was looking at one character, and I was looking at several, and then something, you know, your antenna is up, and you're in the world, and you're looking around. And one thing that Hannah, you'll note that I've mentioned in the book is things are thrown at you. And I just, something was thrown at me, and they had recently discovered a cache of 170,000 pages of documents, Yiddish documents, that were hidden from the Nazis and hidden from the Soviets, and they found them in a church in Lithuania.
Yeah, yeah.
And among those were autobiographies, anonymous mostly, and they haven't been seen since 1939 of teens. And I heard about this, and I went insane, and I got in touch with everybody that I could, and I spent my summer vacation in Vilnius, Lithuania, working on that.
So that is,
it's very, very exciting. But I love the idea of telling nonfiction stories through pictures, because, you know, geography is destiny, and characters come to life. And Hannah, you know, I got in trouble the other day with somebody. I would never call her Hannah, but I've lived with her so much.
Right.
I feel like kind of.
Well, and this is a personal biography. It's not like you're. It's not a scholarship thing.
It's trying to revive and translate some ideas that I think really are worthy of being in the discussion and in the public arena. So Hannah, I think, was brought to the public through this. I hope in a way that will make people want to explore more. And in this next one, you know, hopefully that will go that way too. So thank you for asking, it's a wonderful pursuit.
You inspired me to start reading Hannah Arendt again. So
Walter Benjamin, and then Levinas and Jaspers, and it's fun.
It's pretty cool.
Aristotle said knowledge is pleasurable, and I think it is.
It's a good thing to be reminded of.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Ken. This has been great.
Well, thank you.
It's been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Ken Krimstein about The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt, and thank you very much.